Tonight on Arena, Mary McGill on the series of the moment, Normal People, and poet Sean Hewitt talks about his debut collection, Tongues of Fire. #51551 is the text. You can tweet the programme at RTE Arena. The 12-part adaptation of Sally Rooney's best-selling novel, Normal People, starts on RTE One television tonight. The opening episodes are directed by Lenny Abrahamson, whom we spoke to on the programme last week. Normal People chronicles the highs and lows of the relationship between Connell and Marianne as they try to keep their feelings secret from their social circles. Mary McGill has been watching the series for us and she joins me now. Just for those who are not familiar particularly with Sally Rooney's novel, Normal People, just explain who Marianne and Connell are, Mary.
Marianne and Connell, well, they are, initially when we meet them, they are two teenagers going to secondary school in Sligo, and they are in two very, very different worlds, or at least so it would seem on the surface. Connell is a big man on campus. He's a GAA star at the school. He does really well academically, but he's also super popular. He lives with his single mum, Lorraine. They have a very close, very supportive relationship. So he's in a really kind of strong, emotional, social space when we meet Connell. By contrast, Marianne is very isolated. She doesn't get on well with her teachers. She has a fierce misgiving of authority of any kind. Her home life, we get these shadows of an abusive, albeit, you know, very nice in a material sense, middle class existence. She's a loner. She has no access to the kind of social sphere that Connell has. And indeed, his friends, who's very close with, are very dismissive and even outright kind of teasing and mocking of Marianne. So they seem like they're on two different or in two different worlds, but in reality they actually have a very, very deep connection in many respects. So they look like they're from two different worlds initially, but in truth they actually have a world that they share together that is uniquely theirs.
All right, and part of that is how they are perceived at school. And I listen to a clip now where we'll hear that Marianne, played by Daisy Edgar-Jones, Connell, played by Paul Mescal, and they're talking about how they think they're perceived at school.
Something cool is the first word most people would associate with me.
What would that be then?
I don't know. Annoying. Obnoxious. Argumentative, definitely.
Self-righteous. Probably one. Arrogant. Frigid.
No, stop it. No one says that about you.
People do say I'm annoying.
So what? People probably say that about me too.
No, they don't. No one finds you annoying. Shy people aren't annoying.
You think I'm shy? Just because I don't give my opinion on everything all the time.
You never give an opinion about anything. Ever.
Daisy Edgar-Jones there as Marianne and Paul Mescal as Connell in that clip from Normal People, which starts the television series, which starts on RTE1 television this evening. We get a sense from that, Mary McGill, just how gentle the relationship is between the two of them. They seem to be able to just open up to each other in a way they cannot do with anybody else.
100%, Sean. It is this incredible tenderness that has been transformed from the book. And I would say you don't need to have read the book to watch and enjoy this show, but there is an incredible tenderness between these two characters, this connection. It is both intellectual, it is both it's also sexual. Even, you know, the way Rooney writes about sex is I mean, you can project all the salaciousness you want onto it, but fundamentally it's about how characters are communicating with each other in a different kind of language. And we really see this with Marianne and Connell, and when they're together, you know, there's in the so-called other world, the real world in which they spend, I suppose, most of their time when they're not together, you know, it's a complex relationship because of class as well. Lorraine, Connell's mum, is the housekeeper for Marianne's mother. So when they do get to be together, it is because of that connection that allows them this kind of alone time, because, you know, Connell will be picking up his mum and so on at her house. But they manage to, in those kind of stolen moments that, you know, blossom into something so much more, they manage to convey this kind of really, and I think this is what really brings people to this story. In some ways, it's so modern and it's so contemporary, and then in other ways, it's just so timeless, because it is this incredibly tender love story between these two young people who are doing what young people do, Sean. They're trying to figure it out, and they're making a very bad job of it a lot of the time. But they have this tenderness that keeps bringing them back to each other.
You went to school in Sligo, Mary. Normal People is set in Sligo. So yes. How familiar a world was it, the Sligo part of it at any rate?
Well, I mean, part of me was like, are they going to do kind of a Beverly Hills 90210 on this and make it more, maybe glamorous for a British audience or water down the Irishness of it? I must say, Sean, it was very, very recognisable to me, as a more kind of modern version of, you know, secondary school in Ireland. But you know, we've got the Debs, we've got the Leaving Cert, we've got Gaelic Games. You know, it is very much an Irish story. And I certainly, as somebody who would have gone to secondary school in Sligo, yeah, I was pleasantly surprised to see how relatable it was and how respectful they had been of that experience that Rooney writes about so well.
But, you know, the setting of Sligo is not absolutely essential to the novel. It could, or the television series for that matter. It could be any small town in Ireland. Could it be any small town anywhere in the world? Because this is a production that's been sought at, that is being broadcast in both England and America. Does it have that universal appeal, do you think?
I absolutely think that it does. And I think part of that is perhaps down to the kind of a reputation that has built up around Sally Rooney, which I feel kind of, you know, sometimes the actual books themselves and her work as a writer kind of gets lost under all this hype about her being, you know, the Salinger for the Snapchat generation and all this, you know, this kind of global attention that is, you know, certainly warranted her, that the stories are great, her writing is fantastic. But I think that she's spoken a lot about her, she enjoys reading kind of classic novels from the golden age of novel writing, 19th century, 18th century. And so those universalizing themes about what it means to be in love and the difficulties that people get themselves into, I mean, these are themes that have been explored ever since people started creating art. And they are themes that she brings a kind of a 21st century sensibility to, but they are also very much long-standing themes.
What about the nature of the masculinity that we see portrayed in the book, or in this television series? We're talking about the series, not the book.
Yeah.
That we see portrayed as by Paul Mescal in particular in the character of Connell. He is the, you know, the big star. So there was this possibility that we'd go down, oh, he's a kind of a, you know, a jock type of thing, to put it in American school, high school parlance. What is the nature of the masculinity we see portrayed?
Well, I think it's really interesting because you just played a clip there in which we get to see the really emotionally aware, vulnerable Connell. And this is what Marianne taps into and sees and admires. She admires his intelligence. She admires his love of reading, which he hides from his friends, just like he hides his relationship with her. And this is where Connell gets complex and where he lets himself down and actually self-sabotages. He is, on the one hand, hugely attached to Marianne. I mean, he loves this girl. But on the other, he's very much attached, Sean, to that notion of the jock. Like, he's a great time in school. He's a popular guy. Everybody wants to be around him. And he does not want to compromise that by admitting, quote unquote, that he's going out with Marianne. And of course, when Lorraine, his mum, finds out about this, she is not at all impressed. And of course, Lorraine is a single mother and so on. I mean, she is a very brilliantly played by Sarah Green, but she is a kind of a moral force in the story. You know, she tells him she's upset with him and disgusted by him, by the way he is treating Marianne. And of course, Connell being Connell, this is a smart guy. He knows what he's doing, but he just doesn't have, at least when we meet him first, the strength of character to stand up for what he loves, essentially. But mind you, I will say that the power dynamics in this relationship ebb and flow throughout the story. So it gets interesting.
Yeah, we'll listen to a second clip, and this is all around about how things are going to turn out at college. Again, Marianne Daisy Edgar-Jones, she's encouraging Connell by Paul Mescal to change his choice of college, in fact, and to join her in Trinity.
You should change to English.
Do you actually mean that, or are you joking?
No, I actually think you should. It's the only subject you really enjoy. And you spend all your spare time reading.
Where would I study English in Galway?
You could come to Trinity.
You're pretty confident you're going to get in, are you? Well, then we'd be in college together. I bet you'd pretend not to know me if we bumped into each other. Sorry.
I would never pretend to not know you, Connell.
Would you not?
No.
It's just so beautiful the way they speak to each other in those final two lines. I'd never pretend to not know you, Connell. Would you not? No. It's so straightforward, yeah. Mary McGill. You've looked at the six episodes at this stage of Normal People.
I have, and that's exactly it, Sean. I mean, Rooney's really interesting in terms of what she does with silences and quietness, and she's not afraid to leave them in there. Like when you just tapped into it perfectly there, like that is a very quiet moment. The dialogue is minimal, and yet we are getting so much there about the connection these characters have and the intense vulnerability that they feel. Like we all feel it or felt at that stage of our lives. But indeed that, you know, being in love, being in any kind of romantic relationship or indeed any human relationship can make you feel very, very vulnerable. And she's also, you know, in this adaptation, they're not afraid to leave that quietness in there, which I think is very brave. They're not afraid to let the camera, we'll say, linger on a character's face. Well, they're not saying anything, but they're clearly feeling. And we as an audience are expected to be able to, you know, to interpret that and sit with that. And I think that is part of what gives this series, at least the episodes I've seen of it, this, you know, it's very distinctive. It feel, again, you know, we've got this kind of classical universal love story, and yet it is about, you know, two people trying to find each other in a world that is very modern and very isolating and complicated as well, because language and people and all these things and power being what they are, it can be tricky to find your way to someone even when you love them. And I think Marianne and Connell are a classic example of that.
What about the sex scenes? They are incredibly explicit. They last for a long time. I mean, there's an episode, there's a scene at the beginning of episode two, which is a good 10 minutes. It's a third of the episode. Very explicit. Yes, the tenderness is still there, but you need to know that you that's what you're going to be watching.
Absolutely. Look at if that makes you uncomfortable, or if it makes people you're going to be watching the television with uncomfortable, then look at you've been warned now, you know, not to maybe watch it in private. But look, it would have been unfaithful to the book to downplay the sexual connection that Marianne and Connell have. You know, they say this themselves, you know, it's they cannot replicate this connection that they have with anybody else. And sex is a big part of that. And I think, again, it's, you know, the way it's handled in the book and in the series is, you know, Sean, it's grown up, it's realistic, it's awkward, it's, you know, and again, this word tender, it's all of these things. It's, you know, we live in a culture that is saturated with a very particular type of pornified sex, whereas what we see here is, I think most people will, you know, see something deeply relatable and probably deeply awkward and occasionally embarrassing as well. But I think it's a far more honest account of what sex is between people, not just, you know, in a physical sense, but also emotionally and intellectually as well. So heads up, yes, you've been warned, there is a lot of sex, but I don't think it serves a kind of just a sensational or you know, a kind of a, you know, it's there for a reason. It serves a very important purpose.
You've watched six episodes. Can you wait to watch the remaining six? And can it hold you for that? I mean, it's very quiet, it's very tender, and not a lot happens in some ways. Can it hold you for another six episodes?
Listen, I've read the book, so I know how it ends, and it absolutely can. This is not a story, and it's not a series about a big bombastic plot, but it's about two people who are, you know, interesting and compelling in their own right, but are just absolutely wonderful together, and all the ways they complicate their being together. And I think a lot of people, anyone who's ever been young and who's ever been in love, will identify with elements of Marianne and Connell's story. So yes, I will definitely be back for the rest of it.
That's Mary McGill speaking to us about Normal People. It starts tonight with a double episode on RTÉ1 television at 10:15. 20 past seven on Tuesday night's Arena. Tongues of Fire is the first collection from poet Sean Hewitt. You might remember this time last year, Sean was on Arena to read his poem Ode to the Dead Zoo, a poem celebrating the National History Museum on Merrion Street in Dublin. So it's no surprise that many of the poems in this new collection celebrate the natural world. And Sean Hewitt joins me now on the line. Perhaps the best way I can actually get you to exemplify that celebration of the natural world is by reading the opening poem, Sean, in the collection, which is simply called Leaf. Will you start with that?
Yeah, of course. I'll just go ahead. Leaf. For woods are forms of grief grown from the earth, for they creak with the weight of it. For each tree is an altar to time. For the oak, whose every knot guards a hushed symbol of water. For how the silver water holds the heavens in its eye. For the axle tree of heaven and the sleeping coil of wind and the moon keeping watch. For how each leaf traps light as it falls. For even in the nighttime of life, it is worth living just to hold it.
And that's Sean Hewitt reading his poem Leaf from his debut collection, Tongues of Fire. As I said, Sean, the natural world, vitally important. And you list out so many aspects of the natural world and other things in that poem. It struck me that perhaps in these times when we're also confined to our homes in many ways, this is a way of heading off out on a virtual walk. These things take on a meaning that perhaps you hadn't intended when you wrote them.
Yeah, absolutely. Looking back at the collection now, it seems amazing that you could find yourself outside so often. But yeah, all of the poems in the book really take place outside, usually in woodlands. So I suppose it might be a nice way of people taking a journey outside if they can't physically go out, which is the magic of books, I suppose.
Is that in any way a reflection of how you write? Do you sit at the desk imagining yourself in the outside world, or in fact are you often, you know, do the ideas come in the walking process, if you like, or in when you're outside yourself?
Yeah, I usually go outside. I take photos on my iPhone or write notes in a notebook, and then I come back and the desk is where I write the poem. But I often make notes outside and sit around and look at what's going on and then try and turn it into a poem when I get home.
And at the moment, how are you managing with all of that?
not very well, to be honest with you. But I suppose we've all got so much else to think about right now. It's just often a case of getting through. You know, I imagine the poems come after you've experienced something. So it's often a tough call to write when you're still in the middle of experiencing something. So I'm trying not to put too much pressure on myself to write about coronavirus or anything else. I'm just letting myself get through the day.
But you are dealing with coronavirus at home, I believe.
Oh yeah, we're all actually fine. But yeah, we did have a positive test, but we actually ended up basically asymptomatic, so that was very lucky of us.
All right.
So yeah, we're all back to normal.
Just going to the final line in that poem that you read for me, Sean, Leaf. That final stanza, in fact, for even in the nighttime of life, it is worth living just to hold it. That struck me as a very important line around the story of your father and the unfortunate aspect and sad aspect of your father's story in relation to the publication of this book.
Yeah, well, unfortunately, Dad died on the same day that I signed the contract for the book. So that meant that I went back and I wrote probably an extra quarter of the book in the couple of months after I signed the contract, which deal with grief and loss. And it seemed to me that many of the poems that I'd written earlier then took on a new meaning when the book had that theme running through it too. So yeah, weirdly prophetic in a way, but that's, I suppose, why that poem is at the start of the collection, because it echoes forth what comes at the end.
It must also complicate your relationship with, I mean, a debut collection being published is a hugely exciting moment, I would have thought, in any poet's life. It must complicate, your father's death must complicate that relationship.
Yeah, I mean, I have a really weird relationship with the book now, I suppose, because what should have been a celebratory moment now comes linked in with a sense of loss. And, you know, Dad is all the way through the book now. And I think of it as his book as much as it is mine. So in some ways that's special because he is in those poems. But again, a weird relationship with them because his death is what brought those poems about. So I have a certain amount of resentment towards them. But I suppose, yeah, he gets to live on through those poems, and that's a nice thing.
And to what extent do you think, it's often a question that comes up to poets in particular for some reason, the writing of a poem about grief or the writing of a poem that might relate specifically to a recent event. To what extent did that help you process that grief, deal with that grief, go through that grief?
I suppose it did help in that when you're going through grief, as many listeners will know, you have such a conflicting mass of emotions. It almost feels sometimes that you can't separate out the strands of them because it's just so overwhelming. And getting it out on paper really does help you to settle down exactly what it is you're thinking and how things relate through. So I suppose in that sense, I do find it cathartic in a way. Although, you know, writing a poem and getting it all out on paper, I suppose even if you thought of it in a therapy way, that's never a fun process either. It might help in the end, but a tough one. But
did you study, and if so, where did you study Willa Hivna, the great medieval poem about Sweeney, Mad Sweeney, Sweeney Astray, whatever we want to call it?
It was an undergraduate. We had to take a language module. I did a degree in English. We had to do a language module, and I went to a state school in England. So my language education was generally not very good. So I decided to opt for a language that I had no experience in. So you could do French literature or whatever. And I thought, why not choose Old Irish, which turned out to be a very difficult language and gave me a lot of introduction to a lot of weird and wonderful texts. And Willa Hivna was one of those. And it was only maybe 4 or 5 years later that I came back and decided to have a go at it myself.
And in what language were you reading it in? Middle Irish, or were you reading translations? How could you approach that?
I had a very laborious job of doing a straight translation of my own, and I didn't do the whole thing. And I read it then in a dual edition, and then I read some other versions of the poem. So I got a few different angles to come at the text from, because my Irish wouldn't be good enough to do it all by myself. But I suppose in a way that's quite nice because I have the bare bones of it and then I can invent a poem around it. So that gives me a certain degree of license in not having to stick exactly.
Yeah, you give us seven Sivna poems in this new collection. What aspects, what was it about Sivna's stray or wanderings, if you like, and his journeys and his heroic escapades? What attracted you to the character as poetic material?
I thought he was a really interesting character in terms of his own personhood is what I found interesting about him. So I kind of stripped away a lot of the narrative architecture of the poem. And instead I've just left in moments where he's longing to come back to the world or where he's dealing with living outside in the elements. He's homeless, where he undergoes a process of grieving, where he falls in love, those sort of aspects. And I found him a very compelling and quite vulnerable character, I suppose, is what I was attracted to.
Will you read one of the Sivna poems for us? Sivna is wounded and confesses.
Yeah, I thought I'd read this poem because it seemed to me when I looked back at the collection that it spoke very much to ideas of self-isolation that we're going through now. So, this is Sivna is wounded and confesses. And it comes at the end of the sequence when Sivna is pierced in the side with a spear and he makes this confession. There was a time when I thought the sound of a dove cooing and flitting over a pond was sweeter than the voices of friends. There was a time when I preferred the blackbird and the boom of a stag belling in a storm. I used to think that the chanting of the mountain grouse at dawn had more music than your voice, but things are different now. Still, it would be hard to say I wouldn't rather live above the bright lake and eat watercress in the wood and be away from sorrow.
Sivna is wounded and confesses, one of the Willa Sivna poems in Sean Hewitt's new collection, Tongues of Fire. That title, Tongues of Fire, Sean, initially I thought, oh, this is some kind of Pentecostal reference here with the tongues of fire coming down in the heads of the apostles, etc. What exactly was in your mind with that title?
Well, it actually comes from the name of a fungus, which is on the cover of the book, and it's these orange tongues that come through a juniper branch, and the common name of it is Tongues of Fire. But I was thinking, I suppose, Pentecostally, and that comes through at the end, but also in terms of kind of the burning bush and in terms of the divine kind of speaking through the natural world. And all the way through the book, I suppose I'm listening out for messages in nature or trying to interpret things, or that's what the characters are doing too. So it seemed a fitting title in that sense.
Given that you've said to us that being out and about is a large part of your inspiration in terms of the writing of the poems, using your iPhone to capture the memories and to bring them back to the desk with you, is having the debut collection up and out there a great distraction from having to do any writing? You can do interviews like this and you can say, well, I'm working. I don't have to write anything at the moment.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, I've got a great excuse in that I can't go out. I've got plenty to do in terms of getting this book out. And I think people will forgive me if I don't write another book for a few years. You know, like one book of poems is enough for a couple of years. So I get a pass for a while now.
All right, don't leave it too long. Will you finish maybe, Sean, by reading the poem Wild Garlic? And maybe as we go into this, give us a little bit of an explanation of some of the thoughts behind the poem.
Yeah, sure. So this is quite a simple lyric poem, really. It comes at the end of the first section of the book, which deals in some ways with trauma and queer relationships. And so this is a nice moment of calm at the end. It's called Wild Garlic, in which I'm out picking wild garlic. Out in the copse after rain, too late after dark to be here. Warm soil, woodlice dripping from the underside of leaves. I root down to the tender stalks and twist them free. Soaked petals dip and touch my arm. Kernels of bud, itch of foliage, of wildness on my skin. The plants are carrying the smell. Earth rich, too heavy to lift above head height. And my boots and jeans are bleached with it. I turn home, and all across the floor, the spiked white flowers light the way. The world is dark, but the wood is full of stars.
Beautiful, and what an uplifting line at the end. The world is dark, but the wood is full of stars. Let us not forget that. And that is the poem Wild Garlic, read for us there by Sean Hewitt. It's from his debut collection, Tongues of Fire, which is published by Jonathan Cape. Now, you may well remember our conversation with Frank McGuinness the week before last about his contribution to Dear Ireland, the Abbey Theatre's creative initiative during this time of COVID-19. Well, the project goes live this very evening, a couple of minutes ago, in fact, at 7:30. Here's a little flavour of what to expect from one of the 50 monologues, this one written and performed by Emmett Kerwin. It's called The Temple Has Closed.
Mark had gotten rid of most of the screens in his apartment, and he'd gone back to listening to the radio and looking out his window. But because everyone else was sitting in their apartments doing the same thing, it was like a whole street of Jimmy Stewarts staring back at him. So he sat with the blinds closed. A lot had gone, like supplies. On the upside, a lot of things had come back. Birdsong in the city centre. That's welcome. Still the pigeons. There was no fast food discards anymore, so the seagulls had pissed off to bully the people of the Burbs and were replaced by starlings or sparrows. His mother would know. She had taught him all of the names, but he'd forgotten. You could hear the river now, and not the endless monoxide stream, two ways, two flows of traffic from the quays. That's gone, that's good, he thought. The God Save the Queen and the Depeche Mode singing Shitebags that ruined his evenings, that had gone too, and that was brilliant. There was marauding gangs of teens on bikes, two wheels short of the madman apocalypse he'd been promised. All of the end of days reading he'd done left him with no idea of what to do in this situation. He supposed they weren't how-to manuals, so... Mark thought that the teenagers on the bikes seemed to be communicating in some new Ridley Walker-inspired Dublin patois. Are you getting his dinners from the chippos? Yes, maybe you're getting his cigar masks on. Then again, he's four floors up and hard of hearing, and the schools had only been shut for a month, no, 2 months, no, four at this stage, he was sure. That's not enough time to create a new Dublin dialect.
Emmett Kerwin there performing from The Temple Has Closed, which is part of the Abbey Theatre's Dear Ireland project, and you can find out more details of how to watch and follow that on abbeytheatre.ie. The 1942 movie Casablanca is almost universally acclaimed as one of the most extraordinary pieces of filmmaking of its era. But the story behind the making of the movie is equally extraordinary. A cast largely comprising some of the most exceptional European acting talent, many of whom had relocated to the United States as Europe tore itself apart. That behind-the-scenes story is the subject of a new film now available on Netflix. It's called Curtiz, placing not Ingrid Bergman or Humphrey Bogart at the centre of the plot, but Michael Curtiz, the Hungarian director who brought Casablanca to the screen. John Maguire has seen the movie and he joins me now. John, obviously every one of the great films we all remember could have another movie made about what happened behind the scenes, but Casablanca is a very important case in point here. What made the context such an absorbing subject for this movie?
Well, Curtiz himself is not the most well-known of the European emigre directors that went to Hollywood in the 20s and 30s, many of whom, like you say, were fleeing persecution from the Nazis. Curtiz was a Hungarian Jew, and he had made something like 70 films in Hungary by 1926 when he first arrived in Hollywood. And... In that context, we know a lot more about, let's say, Billy Wilder or any of the other great studio filmmakers that were operating at the time. But he went on to make about 100 films in Hollywood, predominantly for Warner Brothers. And one of those, of course, is Casablanca. And whenever I watch Casablanca, as I did last Easter Sunday on TV, and I have many times over the years, there are certain moments in it that I respond to in a way that's very difficult to put into words. It's not the pleasure of recognition or the comfort of revisiting an old cinema friend. It's not the goosebumps of the emotional connection with the film or the thrill of the drama or the doom of the romance. But there's something kind of almost ecstatic about it. And not to overinflate it, Sean, but a line like, "Was that cannon fire or is my heart pounding?" That's a joy forever. And it's an objectively terrible line of dialogue, a corny sentiment from a cheap greeting card, made brilliant and made timeless by that context. And the very same can be said about the film that it's in. Casablanca was a very modest production, even by the standards of the early 1940s. And as the Italian writer and cultural analyst Umberto Eco, who is obsessed with Casablanca, puts it, it's a hodgepodge of sensational scenes put together in a rather unplausible way. The characters are psychologically improbable and the actors' performances look slapdash, yet it is movies. And I'd go along with Eco on that. I mean, it is cinema. It does something. The magic that Curtiz captured through a chaotic production that we're going to talk about in a few minutes, a chaotic production, stars that barely talk to one another, a script that was unfinished, a studio breathing down his neck, a producer waving his arms and trying to get him to finish the thing, and the American government, as is outlined in Curtiz, the biography on Netflix, who want a propaganda win. They want a film that's made in Europe, that shows that American characters are sympathetic to the European plight and will go that extra yard, that will be nudged towards action in the European field. And all of that together, I mean, you could watch the film, Sean, 100 times and it's still fresh. There's still something to discover about it. There's still something interesting to watch in it and something that can be revealed. And that's rare. It really is rare.
Well, the Curtiz film, the one that we're talking about that's showing on Netflix, opens with the, you know, the announcement of Pearl Harbor and how that has changed things. And I want to take a clip from just after that, from the very beginning of the movie, in fact, where the World War II setting is discussed in a scene where the US government representative, a Mr. Johnson, played by Declan Hannigan, meets the film's producer, Hal B. Wallace, played by Scott Alexander Young. And they're in the office of studio boss Jack Warner, played by Andrew Heffler.
What's wrong with the title?
Doesn't sound like a war film.
Since when are we making a war film?
Things change, Hal.
Not when we're 22 days into a shoot, they don't. Besides, you don't get Oscars for making war pictures.
Mr. Wallace, I'm not going to tell you how to shoot your movie.
It's Mr. Johnson, isn't it?
He's from the government, Hal.
Huh.
This is the most devastating conflict the world has known. If we don't defeat this enemy, there'll be no hiding anywhere.
I bet they just gobble up that kind of talk in Texas, huh?
Do you know how many films we're gonna make this year? Thanks to those nips, we're down to 20.
Or less.
At this rate, we're gonna be making Baby Ruth radio spots for KFWB. Self-preservation, Hal.
The Epsteins have a great idea.
I don't want it great. I want it Tuesday. Fine, Hal. Tell me the idea.
A woman, torn by her love for two men, must choose between her heart and her head.
Women are choosing now? That's it? That's your great idea?
You're an idealist, Mr. Wallace, and idealism only works in peacetime.
There we go. Scott Alexander Young as Hal B. Wallace pitching the idea of Casablanca to Jack Warner, played by Andrew Heffler. But in the midst of that, John McGuire, the character that really interests me and that I think is at the heart of what this Netflix film Curtiz is trying to do is that Mr. Johnson, a US government representative in a production meetings, telling them basically, this is the story you have to tell. How is that developed in the telling of the film here, Curtiz?
Well, he becomes very much a central character, and the pressures that Michael Curtiz faces throughout the film, he's beset on all sides by pressures, many of which are of his own making. Curtiz wasn't the nicest guy in the world. He was a very, very difficult character. And although this film tries to get towards the heart of who he was and how he worked, it doesn't quite do it. I mean, he had been born, like I said, in Budapest as Mano Kamener, or was it Michele Curtiz? He went through a couple of name changes before he settled on Michael Curtiz. He had made his career and he had arrived in Hollywood, and he was a gifted filmmaker by any measure. He had what a lot of the European emigres that went to Hollywood had, which was style and buckets of it. He could move the camera like very few of his contemporaries, and he could turn his hand to any genre. But he, a gifted filmmaker, but a terrible person. Alan K. Rode notes in the 2017 biography that he did, one of the very few biographies of Curtiz, A Life in Film, that his demonic work ethic approached savagery. And it said that the unreasonable demands that he made on actors and the chaos of the sets, all of his sets, all 102 of them, inspired the formation of the Screen Actors Guild, which is the actors union in the US, and all the rules and regulations about how people are spoken to on set, how they're worked, how you deal with background actors. All of those kind of rules came out of the chaos that Curtiz caused. And the film, the biopic, weighs his personal conduct and finds him wanting. He was a womanizer, a neglectful father, driven only by this pathological need to work. Yes, he was a genius. Yes, he made timeless works of art. But as an individual, he had a lot of failings.
Yeah, and certainly he wasn't too keen on Humphrey Bogart. Let's have a listen to a clip where Bogart is auditioning, in fact, and he's been run through some iconic lines. And the producer, Hal B. Wallace, Scott Alexander Young again, is also involved here.
Of all the gin joints in all the towns in all the world, she walks into mine.
You were supposed to hire actors.
A puppy dog faced alcoholic as our leading man. A Swedish playing a Norwegian. What is this? A comedy?
He could have had anyone.
Sved is vegan.
Serving like everyone else.
Why?
He told me he was going to make America great again. Slim pickings, Mike.
Look at him. Who falls for a man like that? Conrad Veidt. That's an actor. A Nazi playing a Nazi.
He's German, Mike. But if anyone can get the Nazi out of him, I'm sure it's you.
Ferenc Lengyel plays the character of Michael Curtiz, Ladislav Meller as Humphrey Bogart, and once again Scott Alexander Young as Halby Wallace there in that scene from Curtiz that John Maguire is speaking to me about this evening. I found, John, trying to watch it today, a lot of those castings, not even of Bogart, I found it quite confusing to work out who everybody was.
The focus is on Curtiz and almost everybody else. They're not really given introductions. They're not really given backstories. We barely glimpse the character, the actors who play Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart. The focus being so tight on Curtiz means that we have to carry a lot of our own affection and our own understanding of Casablanca, the production of Casablanca, into watching the film. But, I mean, these stories are legendary. They've come down throughout the decades about how they didn't have an ending, how Ingrid Bergman and Humphrey Bogart did not get along. She found him distant and grumpy. They had no affection and no chemistry, and yet they lit the screen with this indelible, timeless romance. The stories about how the production was so chaotic. Bergman has a great quote. When I asked who I was supposed to be in love with, Paul Henreid, who played my husband, or Humphrey Bogart, who played my lover, Curtiz told me, "We don't know yet. Just play it in between." And up until the last minute, they had no idea how the film was going to end. And as they explained, it's quite well done in Curtiz, the biopic. She doesn't choose her destiny, and Curtiz didn't choose it either. It's destiny through the hands of the screenwriters, the twin brothers screenwriters that were trying to get this thing done, the despairing producers, the desperate director, and the government stooge banging on the door. That destiny is kind of chosen for them. I thought that was quite effective in Curtiz as a biography. But Casablanca, the thing that differentiates the film on Netflix from the film that we know and love is that Casablanca is a film that was made entirely without irony. There's no meta here, there's no references, there's no self-awareness, there's no cunning structure. The world that's presented in the 1940s film, that nightclub filled with refugees from all nations, desperate to escape a dreadful evil, that becomes bigger than and greater than Rick's Cafe or the film that it's in. And Curtiz, the biopic, cannot capture that. It would be almost impossible to recapture that sense of time and place that Curtiz, the director at the time, was desperate to put on screen. And as a stand-in for Hollywood, Rick's Cafe, Hollywood was the place that everybody came to. Hal Wallace put together that cast, which included Peter Lorre and Sidney Greenstreet, Conrad Veidt, who had been a major star in Germany and fled the Nazis, Marcel Dalio, who was the star just a few years earlier of Renoir's Rules of the Game. He was another asylum seeker. And Esed Sakal, who people will remember as the waiter, Carl, with his bottle of brandy. He was one of Curtiz's lifelong friends, who was also a Hungarian Jew, just like Curtiz, wanted by the Nazis. And like Curtiz, most of Sakal's family ended up in concentration camps and died in the Holocaust.
Yeah.
They were already in Hollywood under contract. Casablanca is, in many ways, a tribute to and a glorification of the studio system at that time. And some of the best material in Curtiz, the biopic, derives from that context.
All right. Well, that's people maybe should watch Casablanca first before they go to Curtiz then.
I would
on
recommend
Netflix,
Casablanca. Which, absolutely, Sean. Casablanca
okay,
that's first, yeah.
John Maguire speaking to us there about Curtiz, which screens currently screening, in fact, on Netflix. Eddie Linehan is one of Ireland's best-known storytellers as a cultural preservationist. He has amassed the largest collection of folk stories and tales in Ireland, and his dedication to the tradition has seen him collect and compile stories from all across the country, particularly stories that deal with the themes of the natural, of the supernatural rather, fairies and mythological heroes. Now Eddie is sharing his wisdom
wisdom and stories from his home in County Clare on the Tell Me a Story with Eddie Lenehan podcast. And Eddie joins me now. Eddie, when did you actually begin collecting stories yourself? What set you off in that direction?
I better correct something there before it's corrected for you, and it would probably would be, because the biggest collection is by far in UCD.
Right, fair enough.
Collection of folklore. All right, because I have been just privately collecting for the past 44 years. Anyway, ask me a question there again. Where have I been, or why have I been collecting?
Yes, when did you start out?
Back in 1975.
And what prompted you to do that?
Well, very, very simply, or complicatedly, I was studying for an MA in phonetics in UCG, and I had to go out listening to old people's accents. And, of course, what they were telling me, all right, the sounds were fine, but the stories they were telling me was, well, something I had never heard before of the oldest people I had to pick, of course, like in Kerry. That's where I started because I'm from there. And the old people's accents, real Kerry accents, I would call them, I had never heard the kind of stories they were telling before about my own parish, people who had died two generations before, an old man who remembered the Boer War in person, in person, 1899 to 1902. I mean, today we think, oh, well, the Second World War was a long time ago, 70 years ago. The Second World War was just yesterday by comparison with the stuff I have on my recordings. I have people who were killed in the First World War, and he could go back as far as the Boer War. Wow. Amazing stuff.
You have a story on the podcast, Eddie, about a weasel's funeral, and there's a certain sadness to that particular story, given where we're at today and how funerals have to be conducted at the moment. Was it a local woman who told you this story, first of all?
It was indeed, and of course weasels are such an unusual animal, they'd almost know what you're thinking, and people respect them. They're an amazing animal, one of the most, the animal that most stories are told about in Irish folklore, more than any other animal, which is amazing when you consider you don't see weasels that often.
Certainly not. Let's have a listen to a clip from that story. As I say, it's about a weasel funeral. Let's listen to it now.
All right.
And they took no notice whatsoever of her little dog, only straight across the field. And then she noticed that they had something on their shoulders, a couple of them, and the dog backing towards her all the time. And then, maybe 3 or 4 feet behind the first group, another group came out, bigger. Maybe 15 of them. She still couldn't know what they were because they were too far away. And the second group followed the first group straight across the field. Took no notice whatsoever of the dog. And by this time now the dog had come right up to her feet and was there shivering and whinging, obviously terrified. And the two groups of animals had crossed the field by now into the bushes at the other side and gone. Out of her sight. And she asked me, what could that have been? Well, I told her, I know what it was. It was a weasel's funeral. Because I heard from the old people that when a weasel dies, what they do is they'll take the dead weasel up on their shoulders, like we might take a coffin, and take away the dead weasel to the place where they will have scratched a grave for it with their claws and bury it. And the ones that you saw coming up behind were the mourners, the relations and the mourners. And people that might wish to laugh at that, they needn't, because how well your dog, your little pup, knew to get out of the way. Because if he didn't, they would have torn him to pieces. And if you had been in their way, they'd have torn you to pieces as well. Because a weasel might be small, but they are utterly vicious.
That's Eddie Lenehan there with a section of his story about the weasel's funeral and that local woman out walking with her dog. Eddie speaking to me from County Clare this evening. What kind of function do you think that stories and the telling of stories can have for us, particularly at this time, Eddie, where we're maybe finding ourselves confined to our homes and finding it very difficult to deal with stuff? What can story do for us in this situation, do you think?
it can settle people. It can settle people down, because I've noticed, and I said it to my wife here this evening, look at the childish questions that are being constantly asked by people, especially on television, who should know better, pestering the poor doctor there constantly. When will it be over? When will it be over? When is it this date or is it that date? These are people who should know better, I think. I can understand why they're getting so restless. But he should straight out tell them, I think, that, look, it won't get better until, and give them, I can't give you a date. How could I give you a date? Stop being childish. Stop being childish and asking me stupid questions. We're doing the best we can, and it can only get worse if we don't keep doing what we're doing. And you can understand why people are restless and all that. Now, stories, to answer your question, could do a great deal there. I would be only too delighted to tell stories on radio, television or whatever, and I have hundreds of them. And I tell you this much, people will listen. They listen constantly at school, and when I go into schools, the first thing I'll always do to the children is, what kind of stories do you want? And what do you think they want? Blood, murder, gore. And I always ask them, dads, are you sure that's what you want? Because, you see, they're used to television, blood and murder. But when they hear the real thing, I can tell you a place, I can tell you a time, I can tell you a name. And this was the old-style storytelling, because the old-style Shanachicht, around the fire, the storyteller could pick out who was there, and they had to go home across the fields in a dark countryside, probably through a field maybe that had a reputation, or by a graveyard or by an old haunted house, and the Shanachi could pick out somebody who might be afraid, and more than likely was afraid. And I tell you, that was a frightening experience, because remember, all of us today have been born with electricity. We're used to the bright lights, but I tell you, if you had to go past a dark place and you knew a story, a horrible story that had been told about that place, you might find that you weren't as brave as you thought you were. And I know stories about terrible things that happened in particular roads and that.
Briefly and finally, you might tell me a little bit about Biddy Early, who's one of the subjects that you speak about in the podcast, Eddie.
Well, because when the book was republished recently, for the ninth time, I may say, In Search of Biddy Early, she was a wonderful woman, and again, very irrelevant to now, because during this terrible pandemic of ours, she was a wonderful healing woman. 1874, she died, and I wonder if she was alive now, considering she was such a great woman, a kind woman, a great healer. She cured thousands of people. I wonder, would people be going to her for a cure now? I bet you they would. And she would cure, and did cure, and could cure. And no expensive medicines. She cured with, well, her famous bottle. But she did cure. Medicine of the mind and of the body. But she's remembered. 146 years after her death, she's remembered kindly. She must have been a remarkable woman, even though she was married four times.
All right, Eddie.
A woman
well, there
time.
You go. Listen, well, thanks for sharing some of your stories with us this evening. That's Eddie Lenihan there. And you can find Tell Me a Story with Eddie Lenihan, the podcast, wherever you usually find your podcasts at the moment. And that is our lot for this evening. Paula Shields, Leah Murphy, Research. Janice Furphy was the broadcast coordinator. Mark Dwyer was on sound. And tonight's programme was produced by Keshi. Talk to you tomorrow night at 7.